What's up, you guys? I'm Haley.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is Inhuman, a true crime podcast. Since we're apparently on some sort of kick of talking about cases somehow related to horror movies this spooky season, today we are going to be talking about a story dubbed the Friday the 13th murder.
Interesting. Okay.
This is not called the Friday the 13th murder because it took place on a Friday the 13th, but because of the killer's obsession with the movie franchise.
Ooh.
So what exactly happened to Sharon Gregory on October 24th, 1988 may never be known, but there is one thing that is clear. Her killer had an obsession with horror movies.
Mm.
This is the story of the murder of Sharon Gregory.
Mm.
Friday the 13th is a franchise of horror films made up of 12 films and other media. The films, which were released from May 1980 through February 2009, center around Jason Voorhees, a man who was thought to have drowned at Camp Crystal Lake as a boy due to the negligence of the camp staff, but decades later, the lake becomes the setting for a series of mass murders inspired by or committed by Jason himself.
Mm-hmm.
While the character of Jason Voorhees inspired 12 films making up the Friday the 13th franchise, along with a TV series, several novels, comic books, video games, and merchandise, it has also quote-unquote inspired several real-life murderers, one of the most infamous being Mark Branch.
Hmm. Fun fact. Maybe not so fun. It wasn't fun for me. But the week I brought Manny home from the hospital after I had him, Matt was obsessed with the Friday the 13th video game and would play it every single night when I had anxiety out my every orifice of my body. And I'd be like, why are you playing this?
You're like, why this at this time?
I know. He's like, I'm playing after you go to bed. I'm like, I can hear it.
Yeah. Like, I still know. Yeah. No, that's great. Yeah. Thanks, Matt.
Good times.
So Sharon Marie Gregory was born on March 26, 1970 in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Friends of Sharon said she was, quote, an independent, determined young woman.
Okay.
She had dreams of becoming an artist and she loved art and the theater. She was just like a really artistic, cool type of person.
Right.
She was also known to care deeply for all of those around her, and she was extremely close with her friends and family. In 1988, 18-year-old Sharon was a freshman studying psychology at Greenfield Community College, and that's where she met Mark Branch.
Okay.
Mark Branch was also 18 years old, and in 1988 worked at a grocery store in Greenfield. He was born to Richard and Betty Branch, also in Massachusetts. There's not a ton known about his childhood or upbringing, but we do know that Mark had been under psychiatric care for at least a couple of years throughout his adolescence.
Okay.
One report stated that he had been treated at a psychiatric hospital in Boston after leaving a private school called the New Salem Academy 6 weeks into the school year. So he dropped out from New Salem and went to a psychiatric hospital to receive care. And while it's not clear what exact type of care he received, it had something to do with his emotional slash mental health.
Okay.
It's reported that Branch was in two separate programs for, quote, emotionally disturbed adolescents. And Mark's friend since childhood, Scott Landry, later said that Mark's mother once told him Mark had attempted to commit suicide and got treatment for that. And then Scott also said that he knew Mark had gone to a psychiatric hospital for about a year, sometime between his 16th and 18th birthdays, and that Mark also attended a, quote, special school for young people with mental or emotional difficulties.
So it's fair to say he had been struggling for some time.
Yes. And it does seem like his family was doing everything they could to get
him help. Yeah.
Yeah. According to the Union News, Mark Branch was, quote, socially awkward, aggressive, and emotionally disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
And people who knew him would later say that he was bullied and teased a lot in school. So obviously that's not great. Yeah. And then he would respond with like aggression and violence. So it was just this cyclical thing of getting teased, getting bullied, him right. retaliating, it happening again and again and again.
And it's sad because he was probably trying not to resort to that, but it probably was just like the last...
Yeah, like couldn't handle it.
Stitch effort. Yeah, like that was the only thing that worked.
Yeah. Even creepier though, Branch reportedly would talk about killing people. Scott would later tell detectives that at times Mark would, quote, wonder aloud how it would feel to kill someone.
Well, that's worrisome.
Yeah. So that's not quite so... you know, just struggling with your mental health. I mean, still struggling with mental health, but not just like acting out against bullies.
Yeah.
Sometimes when I don't feel like reading or watching TV, I just want to sit back and play a fun game on my phone. And I recently started playing June's Journey. And when I tell you I'm loving it, that is an understatement. I'm already on the fourth chapter and I've only been playing for a few days. June's Journey is a hidden object mystery game and I love it because it brings out my inner detective. You play as June Parker in the 1920s trying to solve her sister's murder. It's so much fun to travel the world of the 20s looking for clues that are indicating that June's family has some dark secrets. You also get to create and decorate your own estate island, which I loved because it made me feel really fancy and important. In my last chapter, I discovered a big family secret and there was an unexpected death, but I won't ruin it for you. You can discover your inner detective and play yourself by downloading June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. You can find the link to download June's Journey for free in the show notes of this episode. There were also rumors that Mark had acted in kind of creepy ways with women. One local story alleges that Branch kept files about the girls in his high school and then used those files while making obscene phone calls to them in the evenings.
Files?
Yeah, files with like information about
notes
them.
And evidence and who knows? Oh my gosh, pictures. That's sick.
He also allegedly wrote notes to girls in his school talking in gruesome detail about how he was going to kill them.
Oh, my God.
So these stories have never been confirmed. I mean, part of me is like, maybe they're not true because nobody like reported anything at the time. But also these are kids. So if they're the ones getting like these prank phone calls or like creepy letters, they're probably like, oh, that's just a weird kid. Like they probably didn't think too much of it.
Like that they were in danger. Yeah.
Right. Mark did have another obsession that many members of the community were aware of. Slasher films. So the clerk at a local video store called Video Expo 1 in Greenfield would later say, quote, he rented strictly gore, period. The gorier, the better. Branch was particularly obsessed with the Friday the 13th series and the main character, Jason Voorhees. Amy Politis, the girlfriend of Mark's friend Scott, would later say Mark Branch would watch violent movies such as Friday the 13th at home. She said, quote, Mark talked about living out a fantasy of being Jason.
No.
She also said that Mark had purchased items that he showed her that had to do with Jason in the movies. So this included dolls of Jason, the hockey mask used by Jason in the movies, and videotapes of the movies.
All right.
Cheryl Gregory, Sharon's sister, later told detectives she, quote, had a conversation with Mark who bragged about having 12 different masks that he had sent away for. And so like the hockey masks that Jason wears in the movies.
Right.
And that the prior Halloween, he had dressed up as Jason Voorhees and, quote, somewhere around the Greenfield Middle School, he had jumped out of the bushes with a knife and chased a girl. The girl ran and he said he fell. He told Cheryl that if he had not fallen, he would have stabbed her.
Oh.
He told Cheryl that because he was unsuccessful, he planned on trying the same thing this coming Halloween, 1988.
Jeez.
And Mark Branch not only knew Cheryl, but also knew Sharon Gregory. They were only acquaintances, not necessarily friends, but reportedly they would spend time together at times. And on the night of October 23rd, 1988, it's reported that Branch was hanging out with Sharon and two of her friends. And then on October 24th, 1988, in the middle of the day, Mark Branch would do the unthinkable. He dressed up just like Jason Voorhees in the movies, wearing the hockey goalie mask, the full jean acid wash outfit, and the black combat boots, and headed to Sharon's home where she lived with her family. It's unknown exactly what happened inside the home that day, but a witness saw him in the driveway. Around noon that day, Sharon's twin sister Cheryl returned home. Their parents were out of town or at work, depending on the report that you read.
Right.
But they weren't home. And Cheryl said she had last seen Sharon that morning at around 8:45 a.m. when she was leaving for school and Sharon was just getting out of the shower. Cheryl did recall leaving the door unlocked, but she also knew Sharon was heading to school, you know, soon not after. That long after. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder why they didn't go to school together.
So it was like community college. They were probably just in different classes.
Oh, true.
You know, it's not like going to high school where like you go to the same school and go to all your classes. They're like,
yeah,
there's different classes at different times.
Right.
When Cheryl arrived home at noon and looked around the house for Sharon, she found a horrific scene. In the bathtub in the upstairs bathroom, Cheryl found her identical twin sister brutally murdered.
Oh my gosh.
Sharon had been stabbed several times in the back, head, chest, and abdomen, and there was blood everywhere. Dr. Thomas Smith, who conducted the autopsy, said, quote, upon first impression, the instrument which made the stab wound was likely a single-edged knife with a blade width of approximately 1 to 1.5 inches and a blade length of between 4 and 5 inches. Death resulted from multiple stab wounds, numbering about 24.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah. 24 stab wounds. An affidavit released by Union News after the murder revealed a lot more details about the crime scene by officers. And honestly, that's the way that we know the most about this case, because all the media reports about this really just focus on this guy was obsessed with the movies and killed a girl. But yeah, there's actually a lot more to it. And a lot of that comes from the one affidavit that we have. So I'm going to share a lot of details from that affidavit because it really like paints the picture of what was going on.
Okay.
Quote, preliminary examination of the deceased at the scene showed evidence of multiple stab wounds about the back and the head, and that the deceased's throat had been slashed. There was a large amount of blood in the bathroom and outer hall, as well as traces of blood on the stairway. The weapon used to inflict the injuries was not found at the scene. The deceased was clothed. Greenfield Police Chief David McCarthy would later say, quote, I have been a cop for 25 years, and this is the grossest killing I have ever seen. She received a lot of stab wounds and a lot of blood. It was a gruesome scene. The affidavit states that Cheryl told officers that Sharon, quote, had recently been concerned about an individual named Mark, who Cheryl knew to be a person who hung around with Scott Landry. So Sharon had reportedly told Cheryl that she was frightened by the manner in which Mark stared at her.
Ugh.
And Cheryl didn't know Mark's last name at the time, but she knew where he lived. So she was able to direct Greenfield Police Captain Joseph LaChance to Mark's residence. Later that day, the police officers would return. But we'll talk about that in a minute. First, I want to talk more about Sharon and Mark's relationship, not in the sense of like a romantic relationship, just like right. How they knew each
other. Yeah.
So according to many, many, many of the media reports, pretty much all of them about this case, Sharon was writing a psychological profile essay on Mark Branch.
Huh.
So allegedly, Mark's professional official profile from his time in the psychiatric hospital was in Sharon's possession, and it's alleged that she was using that to write a profile for her psychology classes. However, investigators were unable to confirm whether or not doing this profile was a part of her coursework for her degree, and they also couldn't confirm if she was writing this profile at all.
How would she have access to that file to write
We'll talk about that in a second.
Okay.
But the reason that this is reported so widely is because the police chief, David McCarthy, said, quote, Sharon Gregory had in her possession a psychological profile of Mark Branch, and that profile was wanted badly by Mark Branch. He didn't like her having it, and he wanted it. She did a profile on him, and she made it known to him what the profile was. This was what the police chief said, and it's very... So that's kind of why it's reported. But when you read through the affidavit, it doesn't really seem like that was what the case was.
Okay.
So according to the affidavit, Cheryl, Sharon's twin sister, was the one who had that official profile. So this is from the affidavit, quote, in August 1988, Cheryl Gregory was present in Scott Landry's living room with Scott and Mark Branch. Mark had some papers with him and told them it was a psychological profile done on him. Cheryl asked to see it and looked it over. She asked to take it home to read it. And just as like a little side note, I feel like a lot of when I first heard this, I was like, why would she want to do that? But like, you know, people were just curious and want to like learn about it. And since he had it and he was like offering it, why not?
Yeah, especially if she's like interested in psychology or studying psychology.
Yeah, and we don't know exactly what Cheryl's major was, but we know her sister was studying psychology, so it's reasonable to think she could have been at least interested in it.
Yeah.
So Mark said that was okay, but he did not want anyone else to see it, and she was to burn it when she was finished reading it. After Cheryl took it home, she cut Mark's name out of it. On Saturday, October 22nd, 1988, so 2 days before the murder, Sharon got a telephone call from Scott Landry asking if Cheryl still had Mark Branch's psychological profile. Sharon went to Cheryl and asked if she had it, and Cheryl told her it was on her bedroom floor. Sharon then told Scott that Cheryl still had it, and Scott said Mark wanted it back.
But he said to burn it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But after Sharon's murder, this profile was never found, and neither was this alleged essay that Sharon was working on. Cheryl had told Detective Clark, one of the officers on the investigation after her sister's murder, that she last saw the profile on her bedroom floor 2 to 3 days before the murder, so when that phone call was made.
Right.
But when they searched for that document in the Gregory house, it was not anywhere to be found. So it's believed that Mark took it with him.
Yeah. I mean, he must have.
Yeah, because it was literally
motive. Yeah. Alleged motive, I guess.
Yeah. So back on October 24th, the day of the murder, officers arrived to Mark's home and his mother, Betty, answered the door. Mark was not home, but she confirmed he did live there. She said that earlier that morning, Mark had gone to meet with his counselor at the Massachusetts Rehabilitation Commission, and then she said she had last seen Mark at the house around 10:30 that morning with his friend Scott Landry. On the evening of October 24th, a witness came forward. So a neighbor of the Gregorys came forward to tell police what he had seen that day. Michael Rockwell lived next door to the Gregorys, and he reported that around noon, he had just sat down to watch TV when he heard a car door closing in the driveway of the Gregory home. When he looked out the window, he saw a dark gray Chevy Chevette, which was the same car that Mark Branch owned.
Oh, what do you know?
And Rockwell observed a man described as about 6 feet tall, weighing 180 to 195 pounds, getting out of the car. The man had a long military cut hair, no facial hair, and was wearing, quote, jean-type pants, a jean-type jacket, both of stone-washed or acid-dyed color.
Mm.
And that describes Mark Branch.
Yeah.
And his appearance.
Because he was wearing, like, a costume of Jake Voorhees. Just so weird and so specific that...
So creepy.
You're gonna get... recognized.
Yeah. Rockwell saw the man walk into the front door of the Gregory home, and then 3 to 5 minutes later, he heard an a car door close again, and when he looked out the window, saw that same person back in the car. He said the car backed out of the driveway and left, and then 30 to 40 minutes later, he heard another car in the driveway, and when he looked out the window, he recognized the car as belonging to Cheryl Gregory.
So then, in 3 to 5 minutes, mm-hmm. he killed her that fast? Mm-hmm. Oh my yeah. gosh.
And I mean, that's just like the neighbor's estimate, so it could have been a little bit longer.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
It is believed that this account from Rockwell describes Mark Branch coming to the Gregory home to murder Sharon. That same evening, detectives also interviewed Scott Landry, Mark's friend. And I'm going to read you the transcript of this interview from the affidavit, or not transcript, the description of this interview from the affidavit, because it is very telling. And I don't want to paraphrase any of it because it's just like, it. You have to hear it how it was written in the affidavit. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
According to Trooper Sychard, one of the investigators, officers working on this case, Scott Landry provided the following information. Scott spent October 24th, 1988 with Mark Branch from about 8:15 a.m. until 11:30 a.m. And remember, the neighbor heard the car at around noon.
Right.
At 8:15 a.m., Scott Landry picked up Mark Branch at Mark's house in Scott's car to bring him to an 8:30 appointment at the Massachusetts Rehab Commission in Greenfield. Scott saw Mark Branch's gray Chevette at Mark's house that morning when he picked Mark up. Mark had said he had no gas and there was an air conditioner in the rear that required repair. Mark declined to drive. Scott Landry dropped Mark Branch off for his appointment. Scott next saw Mark Branch at 9:15 a.m. by Galvin's Liquor Store in Greenfield. They drove back to Mark Branch's house. They got the air conditioner from the back of Mark's car and put it in Scott's father's truck, which Scott had been driving. Both then went in the truck to Scott's house. They arrived between 9:45 and 9:50 a.m. According to Scott from his interview with Trooper Sychard, they went inside to Scott's house and began to record MTV. At 10:07 a.m., Sharon called Scott. Because they were all like acquaintances. Yeah.
Hanging out, kicking it, whatever.
Yeah. Scott answered. She was crying. She asked if Scott had a car. He told her he did not. He asked her if everything was okay, and she said she was not sure. She said she had tried to call her boyfriend, Chris Therrien, at Greenfield High School, but he was not allowed to take her call. So basically, she was saying her car wasn't working and she didn't know what to do.
Okay. I was like, why did she call her boyfriend?
Yeah. So she called her boyfriend. Okay. Boyfriend couldn't pick up. So the next call she made was to Scott, or, you know, she might have called other people, but then she couldn't get anybody to help her figure out what was going on with her car. So she called Scott.
Right. Okay.
Scott told her how to start the car and to call back if it would not start. And according to Scott, she never called back. Mark Branch asked Scott who had called. Scott told him that it had been Sharon Gregory and that she had been unable to start her car. Mark Branch asked why her parents had not brought her to school. Scott told Mark that Sharon's parents were working and not at home. About 15 minutes later, Mark Branch went into Scott's father's bedroom to make a telephone call. According to Trooper Sychard, Scott said he came out a few minutes later. Scott asked him what was up, and Mark said only that he had to make a call. In the next 20 minutes, Mark asked Scott to take him home to get his car so he could go pick up his check at Stop and Shop, the grocery store he worked at. So Scott took Mark Branch home and left. Scott said that Mark's blue jacket was in the back of his father's truck when he dropped Mark off at his house. And he told Mark to take it, but Mark said he would be by to pick it up later after he picked up his check at Stop and Shop. Mark Branch did not come back while Scott was home. So all of this, kind of to summarize, Scott and Mark were together. Scott took Mark to that meeting at the rehab center. They went back to Scott's house watching TV. That's when Sharon called Scott saying she couldn't reach her boyfriend. She was home alone, but presumably she got her car to start because Scott said, call me back.
She didn't call back, right.
But regardless, Mark would have known that there was nobody else at the house.
She was alone.
Mm-hmm. Scott said that after dropping Mark off, he went home and took a nap, and he was awoken around noon. Quote, he received a telephone call from his mother who told him that a girl had committed suicide.
What?
And all he knew was that it was one of the Gregory twins. He went out to look for Cheryl's boyfriend, but could not find him, so he then went to look for Sharon's boyfriend, Chris Therrien, at the high school. He told Chris that one of the twins had committed suicide, but he did not know which one. Chris and his mother went to the Gregory home, and that's when they met with officers, and obviously Chris was interviewed, but he had been at school, so right. He wasn't even in the question. Scott Landry told Trooper Sicard that Sharon and Cheryl Gregory often mocked him and made fun of his presence. Within the last week, Mark Branch had said to Scott that these two girls had angered him. Scott told Sicard that Sharon had taken photographs of Mark Branch and that Mark had told Scott that he wanted those photographs back. And it was later confirmed that two photographs of Mark Branch were found under a box on top of a desk in Sharon's room.
What is their... I'm like confused about what they're... I mean, I guess if they're really writing some kind of piece mm-hmm. on him. But it's like, what is their... Not infatuation, but like almost... I don't know, just interest in him.
Yeah,
you know?
I think...
Like it just seems really... deep.
Yeah, and if they truly were like writing this profile on him and interested, like I think they were just fascinated.
Yeah,
like they knew his history, that he had been in and out of psychiatric hospitals and things like that, and they
do
were
it
just...
on the down low though, you know, like yeah, he's unstable, so yeah, it's kind of like
yeah, but know. It's not even confirmed that
any of that's real.
Yeah, but we do know that those two photographs were found, so that's definitely weird to me.
Yeah, definitely.
The next day, Mark's car was found abandoned near the woods in Buckland, Massachusetts, less than 15 miles away from Greenfield.
Okay.
The car had blood on several spots inside of it, including the pedals, the steering wheel, the shifter, the e-brake, and the driver's side door handles, both on the inside and outside.
So everywhere he would have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The detective that wrote the affidavit said, quote, based upon my observation of the deceased at the scene and the amount of blood between the first floor and the bathroom where she was found, I have cause to believe, based upon my many years of experience in investigating crimes of violence, that the clothing of the deceased attacker is likely to have the deceased's blood on it. So with this observation, it's also likely to assume that the car the suspect used to flee the crime scene would also be covered in blood.
Yeah, absolutely.
So not only was Mark Branch already a suspect because of, you know, Cheryl saying Sharon was worried about him, then the neighbor describing a man exactly like Mark being seen, and now, but they now had this physical evidence with the car.
Right.
While Mark Branch's car had been found, Mark himself was nowhere to be found. He didn't show up for his next work shift on the morning of October 26th, and a massive manhunt began.
Yeah, I wouldn't show up to work either.
Yeah.
I mean, they're coming for you, you know?
Yeah.
Didn't hide your trail very well.
I know.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Investigators not only searched the wooded area near where his car was found, but also followed leads of reported sightings of Branch in New Hampshire, Connecticut, and New York. As more time went on without him being found, the town of Greenfield became more and more concerned. The town's Halloween parade was canceled, and trick-or-treating was moved to be in the afternoon instead of after dark. the local theater postponed the release of Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers, due to fears that Branch would return and carry out another crime during a screening of the movie.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah.
Honestly.
They were also concerned that he was going to return on his birthday because while he was missing, he turned 19 and they were afraid he was going to like return and carry out some sort of crime. While Branch remained missing for the next month, he was pretty much the primary and only suspect.
Yeah.
In the affidavit, Captain LaChance wrote, quote, "Based on this information, there's probable cause to believe that Mark Branch brutally killed Sharon Gregory with a knife or other sharp instrument, and that the killing was modeled on killings in movies such as Friday the 13th. There is also probable cause to believe that Mark Branch keeps copies of such movies and collects paraphernalia such as hockey masks and boots used by the killer in those movies, as well as a doll of Jason from the movie Friday the 13th.
I like how the police like investigated like it was going to be a scary movie.
I know.
I mean, they were like, okay, well, he might attack because it's his birthday or, you know.
I know. Yeah, they really did. Thing.
So they're like thinking like how police thinking. But it,
yeah, movie, but it makes like sense because movies. Yeah. If he's obsessed with the movies, like he very well could be following that same trope.
Right.
So the point of this affidavit was to get a search warrant for Mark's home, and they were able to. When police searched the Branch home where Mark lived with his mother, they found a collection of 75 horror films and 64 true crime books, which in and of itself is not necessarily a red flag at all. Yeah. I think many of us probably have horror films and true crime books and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But with everything else about him, it was suspicious. They also found in Mark's possession 3 knives, and I don't think any of these had blood on them, at least visible blood. I don't know if any of them were ever tested for like blood or DNA to see if they were the murder weapons, but he at least had weapons. He had a machete, and he had several of those hockey goalie masks.
And that is a red flag.
Yes.
You don't need that many.
On November 29th, 1988, the search for Mark Branch ended. A man hunting in the woods of rural Buckland, Massachusetts, came across the body of a young man hanging from a tree.
What?
When authorities arrived on the scene, they immediately knew it was Mark. The clothing and description matched him perfectly.
Wow.
He had been decomposed, so it was believed that he had taken his life several weeks prior, likely right after the murder.
Yeah.
There are theories that like a mob of vigilantes came and thanks to the news reports wanted to murder Mark, but by all official accounts, he took his own life.
Yeah, which would explain why he didn't cover, you know, cover up the evidence more.
Yeah, exactly. Now, this was found only a mile-ish away from where his car was, slash from an abandoned slaughterhouse that police had searched in the weeks prior. Now, this slaughterhouse was searched thanks to a psychic coming up with saying, I think that this place might be related. And police went into the woods, thanks to what the psychic said, and found this slaughterhouse, this abandoned slaughterhouse. And inside of it were some very creepy, interesting things. And when you first hear about it, you're like, oh my God, that Mark must have been like, this must have been his private like place where he went and, you know.
Bear.
Yeah. Because there were like graffiti sayings on the wall saying like, Jason lives. And things like that. But there was also a lot of other graffiti. Like there was the words Freddy lives and there were other things on the wall. But what was really creepy was there was a drawing, like a graffiti drawing or painting of a man murdering a woman with a knife.
Oh, geez.
But also like that's kind of generic. So yeah. Even though you're like, okay, that is creepy because that's what happened in this case. It's also like if somebody was there writing stuff and painting stuff about horror movies, that's not that uncommon.
Yeah, because if it's like a little like secret hangout spot for teens, then they're going to see the drawing. They're like, oh, well, Jason lives. Well, guess what? Freddy lives. And then it's Michael lives and who else?
Yeah, exactly.
Whoever else.
Exactly. So it's not known if Mark actually occupied this or went. I mean, he might have hung out there, but it's not as like sensational as they tried to make it.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because this also was not far from the car and from where he was found. So it's like, how the hell was he not found? But also this was a very densely wooded area. So even though they did massive manhunts, it's, you know, easy to have missed an area. And this is, you know, before drones and things like that, that you'd be able to more easily search places like that.
Right.
After Mark Branch's death, Greenfield Police Chief David McCarthy said, quote, he was so entrenched with Jason that he had to have the final chapter in his own feelings. He wanted to know what it felt like to live out the part of Jason. Mm. However, while he may have modeled the killing after his favorite movie series, the motive is believed to be more related to that of that psychological profile.
Yeah.
What's confusing is that it seems that Mark knew Cheryl was the one who had the profile, and he had given it, because he had given it to her.
Right.
And then that phone call that happened, yes, he then knew that Sharon was aware of it, but it was still in Cheryl's possession. And there was no actual evidence that Sharon was using the profile to write a paper.
Right.
You know, it's possible that that was happening, or that maybe she mentioned that to Mark or something, but there's no physical evidence of that.
Yeah.
There's also thoughts that people have that maybe Mark thought he was killing Cheryl.
Yeah, I thought that too. I mean, if they were identical twins.
Yeah.
And
it's not like they knew each other
with
super
them.
Well.
Yeah.
It's very possible. And if it was really that quick of a murder,
right,
he might have not even like taken time to look, and he might have thought, hey, Sharon left because she didn't call Scott back about her car not starting, so she must be gone.
Yeah.
We will never know the answer as to what exactly his motive was, but either way, Sharon's life was senselessly stolen from her. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow, October 24th, 2023, is the 35th anniversary of Sharon Gregory's murder. Sharon is remembered as a kind, caring woman, and she just had so much life ahead of her. She was just getting started. Her life was just taken for absolutely no reason.
Right.
And it's just heartbreaking and terrifying that he did this. And, you know, he definitely was like inspired by slash modeled the actual crime after the movie, but he definitely wasn't didn't do this because of the movies, which I think is one of the ways that like the media tried to say, like, oh, this man watched the movie and then like
lost his mind or whatever and started
That's
killing everybody.
Not the case.
No, he had motive for whatever reason, you know, we don't really know aside from the profile, but yet he was inspired to kill in the same manner,
right,
and like wearing the costume and stuff, which just indicates to me that he was mentally unwell.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
More so than anything, but yeah,
exactly. So, but that is the story of the murder of Sharon Gregory. It's so freaking heartbreaking. And
yeah, and her poor sister, like,
yeah,
to have a twin and go on the rest, like, half your life with them, and then all of a sudden they're not there anymore. Like, that is
beyond. To be the one to find her.
Yes. Oh my god.
So terrifying and heartbreaking. And
very much.
Oh yeah. But thank you guys so much for listening. We will see you later this week with a brand new episode. And until then, keep it human.
Bye guys.